Chapter 8, New Beginnings. The next day, I left Morehouse for Morton. The day after, Diana and Mary left to resume their positions. Mr. Rivers took me to my new home in Morton. It was a lovely small cottage that was located near the school. It was modestly furnished and quite comfortable. I settled in right away. I soon found my students, 20 young girls and women, to be either rough and ill-mannered or docile and ready to learn. Only 3 could read, but none could write. The village school was hard work at first. Eventually, most of the girls took pleasure in doing their work well and acquiring manners. Their quick progress in some instances was surprising, and I took an honest and happy pride in it. I felt that I even became a favorite in the neighborhood. Whenever I went out, I heard friendly greetings and was welcomed with kind smiles. At this period in my life, I felt as happy as I could. However, at night, Mr. Rochester would invade my dreams. These dreams always involved meeting him again during some exciting crisis. I would soon awake and recall where I was, trembling and shaking. One Sunday afternoon, I was working on a drawing when there was a knock at the door. It was Mr. Rivers, who often came to visit me to see how things were going at the school. We spoke a little, and he soon came over to where I was sitting to have a look at my work. He leaned over to examine the drawing I was working on, and suddenly he stood up straight again. His mouth opened, as if to speak, but then he stopped the sentence he was about to say. He quickly gave me a nod and left a second later. When St. John left, I looked over my drawing, but saw nothing that should make him act so strangely. I thought about the mystery for a minute or two, but soon forgot about it. A few days later, Mr. Rivers returned to my cottage. It had been snowing heavily the night before and all that day, so I did not expect a visitor in these conditions. But there he suddenly was at my door. We sat down by the fire, and he began to tell me the story of a young girl. He assumed the role of the narrator and started off with the story of a girl's parents who died when she was young. He then spoke about the child having to go live with her aunt at Gateshead Hall, then her life at Lowood School, and finally her position as a governess at Thornfield Hall. He ended this part by saying, "Really, it strikes me that there are so many parallel points in her history and yours." "Just tell me this," I said to him once he had finished his story. "What do you know of Mr. Rochester? How and where is he? Is he well?" "I know nothing at all of Mr. Rochester," said St. John. "What I do know is that the disappearance of this girl, you actually, has become a matter of serious urgency. Advertisements have been put in all the papers, and I myself have received a letter from a lawyer called Mr. Briggs, communicating the details of her life that I have just told you." "Did no one go to Thornfield Hall then? Did no one see Mr. Rochester?" I asked. "Mr. Briggs said the letter into the inquiry of your location was not from Mr. Rochester, but from a Mrs. Alice Fairfax." I suddenly felt upset and worried. I guessed that my worst fears had come true. Mr. Rochester had probably left England for some distant land, and I would never see him again. St. John continued with his story. "Mr. Briggs wrote to me about a Jane Eyre. I only knew a Jane Elliott. I must say, I had my suspicions about you. However, I saw your real name written on one of your drawings the other day when I had come to visit." "Yes, Jane Elliott is my alias. Perhaps Mr. Briggs knows where Mr. Rochester is," I asked with excitement in my voice. "Mr. Briggs didn't write me about Mr. Rochester. He was seeking you to tell you that your uncle, John Eyre of Madeira, is now dead, and to tell you that he has left you all of his property. You are now rich, Miss Eyre."
"I? Rich?"
"You must prove your identity, of course," resumed St. John. And after a few minutes of silence, he said, "Perhaps you would now like to know how much you're worth?" I nodded. £20,000, to be exact," he said. I must have looked like I was in shock. It was such a large sum of money to now have. Mr. Rivers, ignoring the look on my face, continued, Now, you're probably not aware, but my full name is St. John Eyre Rivers. I must have still had a surprised look on my face, which he again ignored, and he began to tell me the story of his parents and how they were related to me. Your mother was my father's sister? I finally managed to ask. Yes. So you, Diana, and Mary are my cousins? We are cousins, yes, he replied.
Oh, I am glad! I am glad! I exclaimed. I walked around the room, trying to deal with all of the thoughts that were suddenly in my head. Now that I had family, I had to reunite everyone. There were four of us, so £20,000 split four ways was £5,000 each. With a small fortune of their own, Diana and Mary wouldn't have to work so far away as governesses. They could return to their home in Moor House. Write to Diana and Mary tomorrow, I said to St. John. Tell them to come home right away. We will split the inheritance four ways between us. St. John thought that I was out of my mind in my excitement, but he did what I asked of him. It was a few weeks later by the time all the matters concerning my inheritance were settled, and a few days later Diana and Mary arrived home. They had, of course, found out through their brother that I was their cousin, so our reunion was that much more special. We spent the next few days chatting from morning until night. My heart felt full and at peace while I was with them, but the thought of Mr. Rochester never escaped my mind. In the course of my necessary communication with Mr. Briggs about the will, I had inquired if he knew anything of Mr. Rochester's current residence. He didn't know anything. I then wrote to Mrs. Fairfax, but a fortnight passed with still no reply from her. I decided that the only way I could put Mr. Rochester out of my mind was if I found out where he was and how he was doing. I would seek him out, and once I knew that he was fine, I would return to Moor House. At breakfast, I announced to Diana and Mary that I was going on a journey and should be away for about 4 days. "Alone, Jane?" they asked. "Yes, it's to see or hear news of a friend whom I've been worried about for some time." I left Moor House at 3 p.m., and soon after 4, I stood in Whitcross waiting for the arrival of the coach, which would take me to Millcote. After it appeared, I quickly got on and was soon on the road to Thornfield Hall. It was a long journey of 36 hours. We left Whitcross on a Tuesday afternoon, and early on Thursday morning, the coach stopped to water the horses at an inn. "How far is Thornfield Hall from here?" I asked the innkeeper. "Just 2 miles away, miss," he replied. I decided to walk the rest of the way to Thornfield Hall. As I walked along the way, I started to see familiar trees, hills, and fields. Soon the woods rose into view. I passed by a field, and in a second I expected to see the hall rising in front of me. However, instead of a grand house, all I saw was a blackened ruin. Thornfield Hall had burnt to the ground. What is the story behind this disaster? I thought to myself. I walked around the broken walls and through the devastated interior in horror. From what I saw, I could tell that the disaster had happened recently. I needed answers to all of the questions racing through my mind, so I decided to return to the inn. When I returned to the inn, I asked to speak with the innkeeper. "You know Thornfield Hall, of course," I managed to say. "Yes, ma'am," he replied. "No one is living there now, though. I suppose you are a stranger to these parts. Otherwise, you would know that it burnt down last autumn. A dreadful disaster. The fire broke out in the middle of the night. It was a terrible sight." "Do you know how the fire started?" I then asked him. "They guessed who did it, ma'am." He then pulled his chair closer to me, and speaking in a low voice, he said, "They think the lady kept in the house, the lunatic, did it. Luckily, only a few people were in the house. Mr. Rochester had sent mostly everyone away after the young woman he was about to marry ran away. He even sent Mrs. Fairfax, his housekeeper, away to stay with friends. And Miss Adele, a ward he had, was put in school. He broke off connections with everyone and shut himself up like a hermit in the hall.
What?
I exclaimed. He didn't leave England?
No, of course not. He wouldn't leave the hall.
So Mr. Rochester was at home when the fire broke out?
Yes, he was. He got all of the servants out of their beds and helped them out of the house. He then went back to get his crazy wife out of the attic, but she had jumped off the roof and died.
Were any other lives lost?
No, but poor Mr. Rochester is now blind. After his lunatic wife jumped off the roof, Mr. Rochester tried to get out of the burning house, but a beam fell on him. One eye was knocked out, and one hand was crushed. The other eye was also damaged in the accident, and he lost sight in that one, too.
Where is he? Where does he live now?
I asked the innkeeper.
At Ferndean, a manor house on a farm he owns about 30 miles away. Who is with him?
John, his most faithful servant, and John's wife. He would have no one else live with him.
Please get your coach ready instantly. If your driver can take me to Ferndean before dark today, I'll pay both you and him twice the amount you usually demand. About a mile before reaching Ferndean, I got out of the coach to walk the rest of the way. I arrived at the house just before dark. I knocked on the door, and John's wife opened it.
Mary, I said, how are you? I knew both John and Mary very well from having lived with them at Thornfield Hall. Mary looked as if she'd seen a ghost.
Is it really you, miss? She asked me.
I answered her by taking her hand, and then I followed her into the kitchen where John was sitting by a fire. I soon explained to them all that I had heard about what happened since I left Thornfield, and that I had come to see Mr. Rochester.
While I was speaking with John and Mary, Mr. Rochester rang for Mary to bring him some water. However, I asked to take it into the parlor for him. Mr. Rochester heard someone come into the room, but since he couldn't see anything, he assumed it was Mary.
Give me the water, Mary, he said.
Mary is in the kitchen, I answered.
Who speaks? Asked Mr. Rochester.
Whoever you are, allow me to touch you so I can sense who you are.
He groped, and I grabbed his wandering hand and put it in mine. He then grabbed my arm, shoulder, neck, and waist. He then brought me toward him.
Is it Jane? This is her shape, and this is her size.
And this is her voice, I added.
Jane Eyre! Jane Eyre!
My dear Mr. Rochester, I have found you, and I've come back to you.
I can't believe you've come back to me, Jane. You cannot imagine how I felt when I discovered you had left Thornfield and when I could find you nowhere. What could my darling do with no money and nowhere to go? And what did she do? Let me hear it now.
I then began to tell Mr. Rochester my story since leaving Thornfield Hall. It ended with the death of my uncle John Eyre and my inheritance, which made me quite a rich woman. Once Mr. Rochester and I had been reunited for a few days, we decided to marry. It was a quiet wedding, with only he and I, the clergyman, and a clerk present. I wrote to Morehouse immediately to say what I had done. I also explained in full why I had left. Diana, Mary, and St. John completely understood my actions, and Diana said she would come and visit me very soon. I never forgot about Adele either. I went to see her at the school where Mr. Rochester had sent her. She was delighted when she saw me. She said she was not happy at her school because it was too strict, so I took her home with me. My story now comes to a close. I have now been married to Mr. Rochester for 10 years. Mr. Rochester continued to be blind for the first 2 years of our union, and perhaps this is what brought us so close together. Then one morning, at the end of the 2 years, he told me that he could faintly see things. The clouding in one eye was slowly becoming less difficult to see through. He went to see an eye doctor in London, and he eventually recovered the sight in that one eye. When his firstborn was put into his arms, he could see that the boy had inherited his own eyes, as they once were, large, brilliant, and black. My Edward and I now are happy and truly blessed.